Thank you. Oh, be seated. I'm sorry. Now, I did not submit the last case, so case number 54198, Goodloe versus State, will be submitted. Now we've done that. And thanks to both counsel for doing this. And please excuse us for the people that are scheduled at 11:30. We're going to hear the case now that is the co-defendant of the case that we just heard. So we're ready to do that. This is case number 54234. Frank Smith versus State. This is the co-defendant for Mr. Goodloe and Ms. Cartledge for the appellant.
Thank you.
And thank you for your accommodation to us. We appreciate it.
Yes, sir. My name is Glenn Cartledge, and I'm appointed counsel for Frank Smith. And I am appearing this morning at 11 o'clock rather than the scheduled 2 o'clock to follow up on some of the statements that were made this morning by both counsel.
It'll make it much easier for us, too, to have the cases like this.
Right, and I thought it would be easier for you, and I thought it would also be more beneficial for Mr. Smith. I will apologize to the court, though, in that I had anticipated working on my argument between now and 2 o'clock, so I may be shooting from the hip somewhat. I am, of course, familiar with the facts of the case and the briefs having been filed in this matter. My two arguments this morning were going to be on the exact issues to which the court listened, and I would like to also briefly discuss the severance issue. The others, I think, are more appropriately submitted on the briefs, and in addition, I think some of them may be more appropriate for post-conviction hearing, although that involves a brand new process, more judicial resources, and I think if we can solve some of these things here on the direct appeal, it would be a better venue. What I'd like to start out with is to discuss, first of all, the judicial comments made by the trial court. And one of the things that my esteemed colleague, Mr. Hadlesat, said this morning was that these need to be taken in context. And he's correct, although I think part of the context of this is some of the things that the judge said before. He commented about Ho Chi Minh, Saddam Hussein, and Adolf Hitler. And what he said was, this is, and I'm going to quote him here, I mean, we are dealing with serious stuff. This is not jaywalking. This is not municipal court. This is not spitting on the sidewalk. This is state court. This is serious. When I say major league stuff, here it is. It's a murder trial. Two defendants, same charges as to both defendants. And then he goes in to talk about the quote that we're all so familiar with, and that is about Saddam Hussein, Adolf Hitler, and Ho Chi Minh. What's to be understood is we have two African Americans from out of town appearing in this court. When he said to the jury, I cannot say that I hated Adolf Hitler, I cannot say I hated Ho Chi Minh. What is he saying? I guess he's saying, I can't say that. He's not saying I don't hate them. And he's cluing, for me at least, to the jury that that's something you can't say. I mean, that's the way I read it. I also think that when he's talking about these individuals and he's just beginning to do a murder trial on two African Americans from out of town and they're mass murderers, that needs to be taken into consideration because that's who he's comparing them to. These were highly prejudicial. This is the beginning of the trial. It sets the whole stage for the trial, and it wasn't cured, in my opinion, even by the jury instruction later on, several days later.
When was the mistrial made then, after all this?
When was the motion for mistrial?
Mistrial made.
I'm not exactly sure. I think it was made almost contemporaneously with this, but I can't really answer.
Is that an issue on appeal, the failure to grant the mistrial by Judge Kosach? Has that been raised by Mr. Smith on this appeal?
Well, Mr. Smith has raised a number of issues, and yes, I believe it was, but he has a number of problems, Mr. Smith does, and that is that he's got some plain error standards that he has to deal with because trial counsel did not raise a number of issues. He joined in some and not others.
The motion for mistrial, I'm sorry, I know you weren't there, and I got to know who made the motion and when the motion was made. And we'll go back through the transcript, but was it made by Smith's attorney or the co-defendant? And we need to know that because we have to see if the issue was preserved in a plain error.
Yes, Your Honor, and let me get back to that on rebuttal.
Okay, fair enough.
Or you can ask Mr. Hattlestad about that. I'm sorry, I'm not sure on that. We raised so many issues in this that, and like I said, I was going to prepare for those couple of hours in between, so I can't really answer that. I'd also like to comment about the Batson issue. Mr. Hattlestad made the point that the jurors were, the other jurors, that was Chang, Torres, and Ruiz, those were just given as examples of a pattern of discrimination. I don't really think that's true. I think when he raised those, I'm not saying that he's mischaracterizing the record. I'm just saying my interpretation of what he said there was different, and that is that he did raise these as Batson issues. And the most troubling point for me on that is what Mr. Petty said, and that's the mathematical impossibility of that juror ever serving on the jury. And why then was it brought up? Again, I emphasize that these were African Americans from out of town, and I think that's a salient point that needs to be brought forth.
What about Mr. Petty's argument about the third prong, or what he argues is the third prong of Batson? What's your position on that?
Right. My position on that is the judge did not do anything, did not make any facts. I mean, he may have said, no, this is not a racial basis, but that's not a finding of fact. That's really a conclusion based on what we don't know. I know as judges, you've got to have a record that you can review, and how you review a conclusion as opposed to a set of facts makes it more difficult for you to figure that out, and that's why that third prong is put in there, so that you can have that review, and you can't have it here, because he said nothing about this. So that's Mr. Smith's position on that. A couple of things I want to say about some factual points, and that is that there, I know that you've read the facts in this case, and they're quite complex. We set forth a set of facts. The state came back with a set of facts, and for I think it was 6 pages, there were no citations to the record in the state's citations of facts. I think that's because it's based on the video. As a matter of fact, I'm pretty sure that's what it is. The video, though, was a big problem in this case. The video, the state interprets as the two guys up to no good, going into 210, various points, pointing their weapon inside, and so on. Either Mr. Riker was dead, or he was alive, and I think there are some other possibilities that the court needs to think about. There was a second person in that room, and that was his girlfriend. She was in there. They had no idea where she was. We don't know what happened in the first video. We do know, according to the state, that Mr. Goodloe had already shot in the hotel room before the video started, and then he shot again after the video did start. So there was one shot before and one shot after by Mr. Goodloe. That's the way that the state argued it in their brief. We also know that the .45 was the kill shot. My client, Mr. Smith, had the .45 in the video. Who had it before then? I don't know. Was Mr. Riley up against the door dead, or was he just up against the door shot and wounded, mortally wounded, or was he just up against the door? We don't know. But there was another reason for them to be pointing the weapons in and out, and that's because there was a second person in the room. So in talking about the context of all these facts and saying it doesn't make any sense, Smith's argument about severance and Smith's argument about substantial evidence doesn't make any sense because either he was dead or alive, that's not really totally the picture that I want for the court to understand in that context. As to the severance, now I can tell you on this one, Mr. Goodloe did make the motion, and Mr. Smith did not join in this. So this is under a plain error standard. Mm-hmm. And we are arguing that under NRS 174.165, that a trial judge may sever a trial if it appears that the defendant is prejudiced by the joinder of the defendants. Here, Goodloe testified, said, here's the video, Smith did everything, he handed me the guns, he fired the shot, he's the one that said, I hope these bad guys die, and I'm not going to use the exact language he used. He's the one that got mad at everybody. But there, remember, there was no language. There was nothing said on the video. It was just that. They had antagonistic defenses because Mr. Smith did not testify.
When are there situations, Ms. Cartlidge, if we agreed with you on a plain error basis that you could ever join two defendants? You know, when can you do it? I mean, we had the Simpson-Stewart case recently, which this panel decided, which was kind of some unusual circumstances on severance and all. But this case, these guys worked together. The evidence was they stuck their guns through the windows together. I mean, the evidence, I guess the jury concluded that your client shot, filed a fatal shot, and the co-defendant filed a shot to the leg of the victim and all. So it sounds like the type of case that if you're going to allow joint trials, this is it, even though your client didn't testify and Mr. Petty's client did testify and all. So just give me the situation, because I'm having trouble on a situation when you would would allow joinder under this theory.
I think there are many cases where you could, and that is where there's no dispute about who fired the shot.
Okay.
I'm not going to name specific examples of my own, but I have had cases, many cases, where it's definite who did what, and it's just a matter of culpability as to the crime, whether it's a first-degree murder case or a felony murder, whatever it is. But in this case, they're both pointing the fingers. I think that's where you've got problems.
But is antagonistic defenses alone enough for us to consider severance? I think that that's not the case.
I think you're right. And I think that in this particular case, however, you've got not just antagonistic defenses, but you have one man testifying about, and I know there were some rulings about, I see that I'm running out of time. Do you want me to finish answering this question?
Please do.
I presume that my presiding judge
I'll give you some extra time.
Okay, thank you. I think in this particular instance, when he talked about his confession, and I know that they blocked some of that testimony out, but where you've got one testifying and one not testifying, that's what, to me, distinguishes this case from so many others.
Okay. You want to reserve some time now?
Yes, sir. Yeah. Just a little bit.
All right.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Sanderson?
Yeah, I know Mr. Hallison's coming back up, Justice Cherry. Maybe I could have couple issues I'm concerned about that if he could work into his time here. Number one, if we conclude Judge Kosach's comments were improper, why is it not prejudicial that the mistrial wasn't granted and the issue wasn't dealt with till instruction number 15 was given at the conclusion of the case? So I'd like you to address that. I'd like you to also address the elements of Batson, specifically the third prong that Mr. Petty talked about and under Diamato and all, and why that's not prejudicial for the court to get in to do what you're supposed to do under Diamato.
Okay. I'm going to be repeating myself a little bit as far as the improper remarks are concerned. Again, no dispute about whether these comments should have been made. I will just concede these are comments that should not be made in this context, period. But I think in order for them to amount to a reversible error, there has to be more of a showing than simply the utterance of improper remarks. As I pointed out, there's never a direct comparison between the defendants and the notorious villains, and importantly, never linked to any evidence.
My question is a follow-up to Justice Gibbons, and that is, and I think I said this in your prior argument, I'm not sure there has to have been those connections made, and we've already discussed that. But my concern is exactly what counsel indicated, is just the very essence of these comments tainting from the very beginning the way that these jurors were going to be looking at this case, and most particularly looking at the defendants.
Well, again, I would say no, in and of itself, in the abstract, no.
I understand you have a difficult hurdle.
Right. I mean, there's a long jury selection process, maybe not as long as every murder case that you've ever had or tried. I mean, it took a better part of a day. There's lots and lots of questions in the case.
Who moved? I saw you reading the transcript over there. Who moved for mistrial, and what was the timing on that?
Well, you know, actually, I brought the wrong volume, but I remember what happened.
Okay.
I brought it so I could read Judge Kosach's comments, you know, the case that came up, which it did. But as I remember it, it was Goodloe's attorney that made the motion, and Smith's attorney joined the motion.
Okay.
So the record's
so,
made.
So it's preserved for both defendants.
Right. There's no problem there.
Okay.
And again, my argument here is, I mean, error but harmless error. which is what you would expect from me, I suppose. But I think there's a coherent ground for arguing harmless error in this case. And
well, no what about his comment when he's talking about, what? I guess afterwards, when he's trying to remedy the stuff that he said, when he says, so I'm not going to let you off the hook, and I'm assuming he means the jurors.
Yes.
I'm going to, you've got to tell me that you don't like Mr. Smith because he's black, you don't like Mr. Goodloe because he's black. See what I mean? Specific as far as why you cannot, before you even hear the case, why you cannot be a fair and impartial juror. So it sounds like, and just reviewing what I have here, it sounds like he was talking about being fair and impartial to Smith and Goodloe when he started talking about Hitler and Saddam Hussein and whoever.
Well, I think that's
right. Isn't
that
true?
I think that's right. It may be, how can I put it, a crude example. Maybe not the best example. But the point of the exercise was to say, even these notorious villains, you have to be fair to them. And if you can't be fair to them, tell me that.
Gosh, I wish he had said that.
Well, yeah, of course.
And honestly,
I wish he'd have said a lot of things.
Yeah, for my outburst.
Or not.
My point is that I also think that he's signaling, and I know we're spending an awful lot of your time on this.
Okay.
I think he's signaling these jurors on how they can respond if they want to remain on the jury. And not.
I don't know. That seems.
Well, he let one juror go because the juror said she could not be fair, and then another juror said he didn't think he could be fair but wasn't sure, and he kept that juror.
Well, I think the I can't say that the analysis is completely wrong, but I think it's too clever by half. I just reading the transcript, and I mean, it's not the record, but
what about this comment?
This is not his style.
Anybody have any member of your immediate family or yourself that's been affected by this horrible murder, horrible burglary, horrible invasion of the home? Is that appropriate for a judge to say?
No, but again, you know. Read the paragraph or two before that. He's talking to a person that was a victim of a crime. You know, these aren't the best illustrations or the best way to get to the end, which is a fair and impartial jury. But, you know, is the means sufficiently prejudicial to vacate the convictions? And as I pointed out, there's at least five things I can identify, at least I think provide a coherent ground for finding a harmless error, aside from overwhelming evidence.
Why don't we move on to Batson then?
Well, I would reiterate the points I made before. As far as Mr. Smith is concerned, he never raised a Batson challenge. Ever. He just said, in response to the prosecutor's remarks about Butler, he said, well, wait a minute. This looks like a pattern to me.
Well,
he never issued a challenge, ever.
Well, I guess the issue was out there. He discussed it, so perhaps it's preserved for appeal there by him just counsel making that comment.
Right, but again, as I said, I'm asking the court to perhaps use a very nuanced assessment of the procedure and the context. Because if you don't want to look at the context and it's not subject to harmless error or no prejudice, or if it's de novo, we're going to lose this case. Because step number three is a requirement. He followed the requirement for Butler, but if there's a preservation of the record on the other three, I've got a problem here as far as
the basketball. Well, let's talk about Butler then. Mr. Petty said previously, I think Ms. Carlich, I'm sure, would agree that it's a structural error standard under Batson. Therefore, so when I asked the question of Mr. Petty in the rebuttal argument, which you didn't get a chance to comment on, can it be harmless? He said no, because it's structural. You know, like, did you want to comment?
Well, that's
on
true.
That
I, again, just thinking about Butler, it's not clear to me how an alternate juror, excuse me, the successful challenge to an alternate juror could be structural error in a trial that he would not sit on, because the alternate juror didn't sit on the case at all. But if the issue is the entire process, then the alternate juror's challenge, proper or improper, is part of the equation. But the cases are interesting on this. At least that was my reading of it. You'll read them, too, as you go through, and maybe you've already read them. Especially the federal cases, they will say there's a duty on behalf of the trial judge to do step three analysis, and then they will go on and say, if the judge had done step three analysis, he would have found it to be a pretext. You know, so by implication, there's this sort of muddle about what's harmless, what's prejudicial, and whether or not it's a plain reversible error without any assessment of consequences. that's an issue in this case. But my point is, it's not necessarily clear that we get to step three for Chang, Ruiz, and Torres, because the record wasn't preserved, particularly for this case. But Butler is fine.
And as to Butler, you're saying Butler couldn't get to Butler just because of the mathematics involved anyway.
Well, again, who knows how things would have worked out.
Okay.
But again, this is a guy that has a record. You don't want to take a chance with a guy that's got a record and animosity with the police, I don't think.
I guess, Mr. Hess, our frustration is we teach the trial judges every year on this, and this Batson issue is a sore subject, you know, and we see stuff. It's Diamapo being ignored blatantly by all these trial courts, and it's very, very frustrating to us on appeal. I'm sure it is to you, but we're just hoping the attorneys maybe say, gee, Judge, will you make these findings here and all like that so you can comply with it? So anyway, that's not your issue. I mean, it's the judges. And all,
yeah, to put a fine point on it, I was thinking about it driving down here, and before, of course, but the judge said five words. I've determined no racial discrimination. We don't have an issue. Because these are clearly not pretext.
See, and I'm tough on the defense attorney saying, come on, make a better record for us so that, you know, if I'm going to argue that it's a Batson violation, give me something to look for the transcript, you know, other than a few general statements about discrimination and about pretext. I want more.
Make a record, make a record, make a record.
And we not only preach that in the criminal cases, we preach it in the civil cases, too. So we don't discriminate between civil or criminal.
Anyway, that's all I have on Batson, so if you want to get into any other areas.
Okay, the other thing I want to touch on real quickly is the severance. No objection at all, right. None. They didn't even take part in the hearing. My assessment, reading between the lines, is tactical. They wanted Mr. Goodloe there so that Ken McKenna could have a shot at him. That's what happened. So I think that was completely tactical. The idea that this is a plain error, I think, is silly. So thank you very much.
Thank you. Ms. Cartlidge, let's see. Let me give you 4.5 minutes.
Excuse me?
I'll give you 4.5 minutes.
Oh, thank you, Your Honor. I'm not sure that I'll need it, but
okay.
I'll
Okay. Well, if you don't use it, that's fine.
I'd like to comment first on the severance issue and the fact that he did not object to it and that this was a tactical issue. I'm a trial lawyer as well as an appellate lawyer, and it's much easier to point to an empty seat than to sit there and listen to your co-defendant stand up and say, he did it, he did everything. It's much easier to do that. And I don't think this was a tactical decision. I think this may have been a decision by trial counsel that needs to be reviewed at some point in the future. But I'm hoping that we don't have to get there, because I think that we have so many problems with this case that need to be cleared up, in my opinion. I just want to make one comment on the Batson, and that is that it's very difficult, it would seem to me, to try a case like this with bad facts, with a video, with a dead person, with the girlfriend testifying, when the judge stands up in front of the jury and says remarks like this that infects the entire process. I don't know how you have a fair trial after something like this. I know that there was never any direct comparison between them and the defendants, but I don't think that's really the point. Having said that, I will submit the case.
Thank you. Thanks to both counsel for your cooperation and your arguments in this matter. Hank, this case will stand submitted.